Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. It's a holiday week. We've got Thanksgiving on Thursday. We'll be off Thursday and Friday. So we have a lot to get in 3 days. And so does the rest of the world, apparently. They'll be trying to get all those news stories in 3 days' time. But we welcome you to the program this morning. And thank you very much. I hope you had a beautiful weekend. I know it was rainy in spots, but it we did get some we got some badly needed rain, and then things cleared up, and it was nice. So hopefully you had a beautiful weekend. Let me introduce our group to you. They've been here just sitting here for hours waiting for us to start. Libby just got here. And we are thrilled to have them. Let me introduce them. Libby Post is with us. Libby is a communications consultant, lobbyist here in the city of Albany in the state of New York, and is one of our regulars on Monday, but really one of our regulars who's been with us since the inception of this program. And we're thrilled, as always, to have her. How are you?
I'm good.
Get you near a microphone. Hello, yeah. Libby. How are you?
Okay. How are you?
I'm well. Good to see you, on this morning. Jim Ketterer joins us, senior fellow of Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I think I'm one of the irregulars.
Yes.
But it's good to be here.
Oh, you're pretty regular. You're pretty regular. It's been a while since Laurel Elder was here. She is professor of political science at Hartwick College in Oneonta, who studies gender and politics, women political candidates, women voters, and women in elected office. And she has a lot to talk about. So, good morning. How are you?
I am doing well. It's been a while since I've been on. I think maybe 6 or 7 weeks. Last time I was here was early October, and I had with me two students who loved being on the show, Zach Corbett, the young man who's running for mayor of his town of Otigo, and Amelia Williams, who had really, I thought, eloquent things to say about the possibility of Kamala Harris becoming the first woman president. And of course, since then, a lot has happened, including the election, and we're going to have to wait at least 4 more years for a woman president.
Well, hopefully the kids aren't in therapy, but it's good to have you. It's good to have you here, and thank you very much for being with us. We also welcome via the phone lines. Fran Berman is here, the Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman, how are you, dear friend?
Well, the kids may not be need therapy, but the rest of us might need therapy. I just want to.
How are you?
Good weather in Northampton, Massachusetts. Last weekend we had bag day, where you get a bag and you shop downtown, and there's a bunch of sales. So there.
Very nice.
What more can one ask for?
And you made out all right, I hope?
Yeah, I shopped the sales as well with my fellow Northamptians. I think that's not true. And it was good. So nice to be back. I haven't been here for a while either.
Well, it's very nice to have you back. We always feel it's a treat when you are here. So I thank you very much for it. Just a quick little shout out. Tonight at 7 o'clock, there's a special event happening at Page Hall at the University at Albany downtown campus. And we are the New York State Writers Institute, and we here at WAMC are welcoming Billy Collins, the former poet laureate of the United States, to the area. And Billy has a brand new book out. It is called Water, Water, and it is fantastic. It's newly out from Random House, and Billy will be at the Page Hall, University of Albany downtown campus at 7 p.m. For those of you who don't know, that's at 135 Western Avenue. But if you just look up Page Hall, you'll find it or look up New York State Writers Institute. Also, the first 150 audience members will receive a free copy of Water, Water as a holiday gift from the New York State Writers Institute.
So, nice.
It's a beautiful, beautiful book, and I think you'll greatly enjoy it. There's just some wonderful work and poetry in here. So that's tonight at 7 o'clock. That will also be an upcoming book show. So we look forward to seeing you tonight.
Joe, can I just say?
Yes.
Billy Collins is a national treasure.
Yes.
So was Joe Donahue.
Well,
so you all ought to get out and go to this event. I think it's going to be a great one.
It's just to share a stage with him. The way this is going to work is he's going to come out. He's going to read some poetry, and then we're going to sit down and we're going to talk for a while. And then we're going to do some Q&A, and he'll do a book signing. And it'll be a really, I think, very special event before the holiday. So thank you very much. It'll be a lot of fun. Again, 7 o'clock tonight. Billy Collins at Page Hall at the University at Albany. All right, let's get started for what is happening and get going for the week. And there is a lot happening. We begin with this. This is the, we've been hearing a lot. Trump pretty much finished up his cabinet picks this weekend.
Uh-huh.
So the cabinet,
such as it is.
I was going to say such as it is, but I don't mean it that way. What I mean is
I do.
Barring any, Matt Gaetz left.
No, Matt Gaetz was told bye bye.
Yeah,
now.
Bye bye. And then Pam Bondi, and so you go through this whole thing anyway. So. Barring changes, the cabinet has been nominated and is pretty much set. So what do we learn from that? And I think now is the time that we indeed can look and learn about this. And this is from the New York Times, a news analysis on America First. This is from our friend David Sanger. President-elect, usually when I say friend, that means that they're nice to us and they've been on the show and they listen.
Ah.
So that's what I mean by that. President-elect Donald Trump's final flurry of cabinet picks and other appointments rounded out what his aides described as a unified, loyal, MAGA-driven administration. But scratch the surface and there are at least three distinct factions and a range of ideology barely suppressed to get through the rigors of the confirmation process. There is a revenge team led by prospective nominees with instructions to rip apart the Justice Department, the intelligence agencies, and the Defense Department, hunting down the so-called deep state and anyone who participated in the prosecutions of Mr. Trump. There is a calm the markets team, which Mr. Trump hopes will be led by Scott Bessent, the Wall Street billionaire who led Mr. Trump, who Mr. Trump chose for Treasury Secretary. He can recite the MAGA lines about deregulation and lower taxes, but would likely try to make sure Mr. Trump's most extreme solutions, like inflation-inducing tariffs on foreign goods, do not end the post-election stock market surge. And then there is the government shrinkage team led by Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, whose goals are widely ambitious. To put it mildly, they want to carve what Mr. Musk says will be at least $2 trillion from the annual federal budget, a figure that exceeds the annual cost of salaries for every federal employee. For the record, the total federal budget in 2024 fiscal year was $6.7 trillion. Laurel.
Well, I think the fact that Trump's cabinet nominations reflect many different ideologies makes sense, since Trump himself is hard to categorize ideologically. His ideology varies across issues, and in fact, he often holds many different views on a single issue. I actually love David Sanger, too. And I appreciate that he's trying to, make some sense of these picks and put them into some kind of typology. But I wonder if there's actually no narrative here, that there is no, like, logical, ideological framework. I think the through line through all these appointments is loyalty, proven loyalty to Trump. They have not been chosen because of their qualifications. Many do not have expertise in the area they're being nominated to head. Many do not have experience running large bureaucracies or organizations. It is their loyalty to Trump that ties this group together. And I mean, this may seem a little trite, but I also think one of the characteristics seems to be that they're attractive. Trump seems to be really big into this, like, central casting thing, and he likes people who look the part and are attractive. And after that, a criteria seems to be that they've appeared on Fox News. And I would just say that I think a lot of historians and presidential leadership scholars are concerned because those criteria for picking a cabinet, are concerning in many ways for jobs that are really important for our nation.
Jim.
Yeah, along the lines of loyalty. So even though there appear to be different ideological camps, all of them have had to pass a loyalty test, and that is agreeing that the 2020 election was stolen. So even, you know, so you have the Fox News people who are likely to say that, but, you know, even people who are coming out of the Senate, like Marco Rubio, have had to say that. And I don't think that there's any one of these nominees for the cabinet who have not said in one way or another that they agree with Donald Trump that the election was stolen. So loyalty is at the core. And then I think there's another element to it, and that is a willingness to take that loyalty and to ruthlessly apply whatever Donald Trump is seeking to have done in their agency or whatever fiefdom they're overseeing. On the specifics of some of these things, you know, government reduction, I think we ought to keep in mind that, I mean, there have been government reduction plans before, and in general, it has not reduced actual government, although on the budget it might look like it was reduced in some way or another. But what it really does is open up opportunities for more contractors. So you could see this specifically in something that, I know a lot about because I've been focused on that part of the world. So our war and then occupation of Iraq, the U.S. military didn't just go to that action alone. They went with a whole host of contractors, mm-hmm. Halliburton, BlackRock, others who were doing the things that in the past the military would have done for themselves. And guess what? They were actually getting paid much more than it would have taken if we had people in uniform doing these things. You also see many contractors in our intelligence services, many contractors at the State Department, et cetera. So I would anticipate that this is really a sleight of hand, that this is to say that this is going to happen and then open up for business. And, you know, overall, I think what we see with these nominees is that the playbook is to focus on key things. There's other departments I think that Donald Trump doesn't care so much about, doesn't have an axe to grind with them. But the military, the intelligence services, the investigative services like the FBI and other parts of DOJ, and the judiciary, which he already really has a lot of people in, and then to target certain places, the media, universities, and civil society. And this is right out of the playbook of any authoritarian leader across the boards anywhere. So just generically, that's the playbook. And it seems to me these are the people who are willing, who are loyal, who are ruthless, and are willing to put that playbook into motion.
Fran Berman.
Yes. But I have sort of three thoughts about this. I don't disagree with any of the other panelists, and I really do think that, you know, loyalty is the big deal here, and that as far as I can tell, you know, loyalty has driven everything. I think Kamala would have expected loyalty too, but not in the extreme way that Trump expects loyalty. So, you know, loyalty is sort of a standard thing for, you know, any political person, but Trump clearly takes it to the extreme, and more so than what we would consider normal qualifications. So I think the revenge piece of it is, at least by my observation, not untrue and scary. So that's number one. Number two, when I look at these folks, you know, I sort of factor in the part that Trump is highly inconsistent in the things he thinks and the people he likes. If they get, you know, more attention than he does, if they say something he doesn't happen to like on any particular day, you know, if they think for themselves, they can be out of there. And I think from the last time he was president, I don't know, did anybody stay the whole 4 years? I mean, I think the number of these folks that will be there 4 years from now will be very small compared to the number of these folks that are there now. So
there were a few, but the number was very small.
Yeah. And then the third thing, or sort of a number of conversations I've had with people, all of us trying to grieve and kind of deal with what's happening, which I'm still in the process in, I have to admit, which is, you know, Trump's approach is sort of revolution, not evolution. And he just wants to take down a bunch of stuff. And I think, if truth be told, many of us think that many parts of the federal government are broken.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, will this work? Well, I mean, the scary thing to me is that he wants to take down the stuff that I care about the most first. And so that's not good news to me. But frankly, I don't know how this is all going to play out. And it really scares me. And I'm really worried about it. But I don't know what to do about it. And so, you know, as I see these folks get put into cabinet positions, you know, it's just not clear at all that they're just going to march in lockstep and Trump is going to have some consistent point of view that just screws up everything. I think that there's a lot of chaos that's going to happen between now and then.
All right. We're going to save the best for last. We'll take a break,
and
we'll come back.
Back.
You can just go nuts when
okay,
we come back.
Okay, great.
All right. I don't want to confine you in any way,
Libby. Not
to
worry, honey.
All right. So let's take a break. We'll when we come back, we'll hear from Libby. We obviously welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you on this Monday. I know the letters are already starting to come in, so we will get to those as well. So all of that and much more. First, we're going to get an update from the BBC, and then we'll be back right after that. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel conversation this morning. We have Fran Berman, Laurel Elder, and Jim Ketterer with us. We've been talking about the Trump cabinet and inside the many ideologies of his nominees, and we heard from all three of them, but we did not hear yet from Libby Post, who we go to now. Good
okay.
morning, Libby.
So I think there's a lot of big egos in this particular, not this room, but that room. And I don't think it's going to be goodness and light. I think there's going to be a lot of clash, and I think it's all going to end up blowing up eventually. You know, maybe not in the first 3 weeks, but I think in the long term. I don't think that Elon is going to want to listen to Rosmani.
Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy.
Right. He's not going to want to listen. And they're not going to listen to each other. They both think that they're right. And, you know, one ran for president, got a president elected. So I think that that's going to be an interesting thing. You've got people like Tulsi Gabbard, who has no business being a national security person, and some of these other folks as well. But what I found the most fascinating in the article we read is Mr. Bissent, who's a gay man. And I'm like, are you blinking kidding me?
And who worked for George Soros.
Yes, he worked for Soros. He raised money for Obama. I mean, who is he? This guy kidding? And he is selling out his community because these folks, the 2025 folks from the Heritage Foundation, want to make sure that his marriage is dissolved, that he can't adopt his kids. I mean, they already are adopted. He had two kids via surrogacy. They want to take that right away. They see us as subhuman, you know. And how is that going to jive? Now, I get it. He's a financial whiz. He's made a lot of money, blah, blah, blah. And he's sort of holding back on the tariff stuff, which I don't think is going to happen anyway. I think too many of the corporate leaders are going to say, are you nuts? You know, people are buying refrigerators and freezers and washing machines and dryers and stoves now in anticipation of having to replace that stuff next year and being, well, 40, 50, 60% more because of his stupid tariffs. But this is a gay man, a married father. And how is he going to sit at the same table as some of these people who actually hate his guts? How is he going to sit at the same table with Miss Lindsay and Mike Johnson? How is he going to do that and have any sense of, sorry, honey, the both of them.
Lindsey Graham.
I think the both of them are closet cases. But how is he going to sit with these people and be able, yeah, keep laughing.
You're
and be
incorrigible.
Able to, I know I am. Be able to have a conversation with people who actually hate the fact that he exists. I just don't get it. I know that there are gay Republicans, and I have always thought of them as absolute sellouts of the community because the Republican Party is very clear. They would like to put us either in a chamber with gas or on an island where they'll never have to see us again. And I'm sorry, I don't care what happens. That's never going to happen anywhere in this, at least not in this country, in some other countries. But I'm not going back in the closet for anybody, and neither are all of my compatriots. And his quote was in the paper was really something. You know, if you had told me in 1984 when we graduated and people were dying of AIDS that 30 years later I'd be legally married and we would have two children via surrogacy, I wouldn't have believed you. Well, Scott, that happened because of the work of people like me and Matt Foreman and the transgender community and other leaders all over this country, and now you're working for a man who will sell us out down the river and, you know, capitulate to the Heritage Foundation and the Project 2025 folks. I don't think they can take away marriage. I mean, the Supreme Court has seen what they did with Roe and the impact that has had. It didn't have the political impact that we had hoped. You know, there were women who voted for their state constitutional rights, and then they voted for him, which I just don't understand. They think, oh, we're protected. But this is two-faced, just total denial of who he is, but also a betrayal. This is a betrayal of the LGBTQ community, as far as I'm concerned, and you know, the gay Republicans have always been there, you know, and for them to come and say, yes, I'm going to stand with Donald Trump, even though they want to take away all of my rights because maybe it'll impact my pocketbook, is really absolutely disgusting.
All right. I'm glad we took a break before that. Anybody else want to comment on?
I might just add, I mean, we have had a number of critiques of his cabinet here, and there's been a lot in the news. I mean, one other take is that his picks are untraditional. And I mean, there's, I think Fran mentioned, like, everyone would agree there's things that don't work as well as they could in Washington, D.C. with our federal government. So I think there's the possibility that people with different backgrounds bring different thinking to organizations, maybe shake things up. Institutions can get set in their ways and they can continue to approach things in the same way just because of inertia. So, I mean, we'll see. Maybe there will be some interesting shakeups. But the other thing I'll say is that in the end, there's a lot of scholarship on presidential leadership and talk about how, you know, who presidents pick as their advisors and how they structure their White Houses and do they use the spokes of the wheel or the hierarchical model. And in the end, it's the president that ends up making the decisions. And I think there's some quote, like, in the end, the president can override any sort of organizational structure that is created for him or that he creates for himself. And you see someone like Barack Obama, he, like, intentionally put people with different opinions in his cabinet. He wanted to hear people forcefully argue different sides of issues, and then he sort of thoughtfully considered those opinions and made his decision. And I don't think anyone thinks that that's how Trump is going to use his cabinet. That's not how he makes decisions. And in the end, Trump is just going to be Trump, and he's going to make decisions in the way he has, which is often impulsively and, you know, in what he thinks is the best, regardless of what advice he's gotten from his advisors.
You know, I think that's certainly all true, but there's relatively few decisions that end up in front of the president. The day-to-day operation of these enormous agencies and these departments in the federal government. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of mid-level people who do things, and there's deputy secretaries, et cetera. But it still matters to have somebody at the top who has a certain degree of competence, expertise, and a base of experience that they can draw upon to do those jobs, to do all the things that make the government work on the decisions that don't end up on the desk of the president. And I think what we see here with many of the people, not all, but many of the people who have been nominated for these positions is, in fact, a continuation of an attack on the notion of expertise. Mm-hmm. Tom Nichols wrote a book a few years ago. It's a fantastic book, and it's still highly relevant, called The Death of Expertise. And just the idea that somebody could say, well, I did my own research, or I have this cockamamie idea, but if I say it enough times and I say it with enough force, it's going to hold true. So to see someone like RFK Jr., who holds a lot of these opinions that are based on conspiracy theory and you know, just really crazy ideas, literally crazy ideas, to have him in charge of HHS. Sure, there are many other competent people there, but that has a real chilling effect. And if you multiply that across, you know, many of these agencies and these departments, I mean, the Department of Defense, I mean, yeah, the guy was he was a National Guard officer, and I applaud him for that. And but he really doesn't have nearly the experience you need to run that kind of complex operation, and on and on and on. So I think that this isn't just happenstance. This is a specific targeted attack on expertise and competence.
We have to remember, I love the uneducated, right? That was Trump's clarion call in 2016. This is the natural extension of this, where you put people who have no expertise, no education, for the most part, in some of these really important positions, who believe in conspiracy theories. Look, this is the bottom line here. As far as I'm concerned, women and children are going to die. Okay, women are already dying, bleeding out in parking lots in Texas and the states, where the doctors are too afraid to end a pregnancy because it's ectopic or whatever. And so women die from that. And children are going to die because RFK Jr. is going to say, don't worry, you don't need to vaccinate your kids. You know, there's a great...
Hey, Libby.
What? Because I just wanted
before
to...
You get, before, yes. You, before you leave the Treasury guy, I have a question for you.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really interested in your answer.
Uh-huh.
Is this an okay time?
Sure. Well, ask Joe, but yes.
Yeah, no, you're fine.
Hey, Joe, is this an okay time for me to interrupt
you? We'll go to a break when we're done. Go ahead.
Okay. So, Libby, imagine we were in the, to me, ideal scenario where Kamala was picking her cabinet people.
Mm-hmm.
And for Treasury Secretary, she picked someone who has creds and someone who was not of her party, or maybe a diverse pick. And I imagine, you know, what would we be saying? Would we be saying, you know, that's a really inclusive pick that shows a lot of courage, both on Kamala's side and her pick side. And you know, okay, this isn't exactly the same, obviously, but I was surprised that you say this guy is like a betrayer to do this, because in some sense, of the many things that depress me about this set of people, this is something that is a little different, different in not a bad way. So, I mean, I, you know, okay, the MAGA thing, I don't know. I mean, that makes obviously no sense to me, but you're going to have to be loyal to Trump in some way, or at least believe in MAGA to be on the cabinet. So I'm surprised that you just feel like, you know, basically no one who's not a MAGA Republican could hold a cabinet post and be okay and be okay about that. I mean, do you really think that, Libby?
That he thinks it's okay, or
No, that you think it's
oh,
okay.
Yeah.
You thought this guy is like a betrayer.
He is. He's betraying his community.
But is this guy not courageous for taking it?
No, I don't, because it's about power and status. And let's remember, I think Obama put Republicans in his cabinet. You know,
he did.
And that was fine. Nobody got their knickers in a twist about that. You know, everybody recognized that we had someone who actually thought and was thoughtful in the White House. And he wanted to put together the best and the brightest, to quote David Halberstam. And, you know, all of that. This guy, on the other hand, is just looking out for his own bottom line and has betrayed the community by going to work for an administration that wants us to go away. If some of these people could, they'd kill us. I know some people will say, oh, that's a little extreme. But I'm sorry. You know, hate crimes against LGBTQ people are through the roof. So are hate crimes against Jews. And, you know, it's all connected together to Christian nationalism. And this guy can, like, sit in a room. I'm in the 40 years I've been doing LGBT work, or however long it's been, 30 years, you know, I've dealt with a lot of different people, and I've dealt with gay Republicans, but there was a limit to where they would go. And this is a limit that's a little too far. This is a step too far for a man who understands, who saw his friends die of AIDS through the 80s, as did I. You have no idea how many funerals took place in Albany because of the AIDS epidemic. And a Republican president who refused to say the word and put any money into research until Elizabeth Taylor came forward about Rock Hudson. I mean, that's what it took. And now this man, Besson, is working for an administration that wants to go back to those days where if gays died, it's okay, because they're subhuman. And I won't put up with that. I won't say, oh, it's okay. They sunk hundreds of millions of dollars demonizing the trans community to mobilize voters, just like Karl Rove did in 2000 on the gay marriage issue. They did the same thing. And so, no, I can't say that this man is brave or anything else. This is a betrayal of the community.
I don't disagree with that, but I do think earlier when you said of loving the uneducated, I don't think these people are uneducated. I think you exactly said that they have pledged loyalty to him, and they know exactly what they need to do, and that isn't. We can disagree with them, but I don't think you're looking at the lowest common denominator that he's putting in there. He's looking at people that will do what he wants them to do, which may or may not
true. But somebody like Tulsi,
the smartest thing to do.
But someone like Gabbard does not have the smarts or the capabilities or the experience to be a national security advisor. Right.
There may be even deeper problems with her.
Yeah.
But I think there's a difference between uneducated and unqualified.
Correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that's what they are.
The nominee for for Secretary of Defense is highly educated, but he's not qualified to be the Secretary of Defense. So it's not just, you know, a degree on paper. This, you know, there's a very small pool of people who can run this complex operation, and he's not one of them.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters and your thoughts on all of this. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we have Fran Berman, Laurel Elder, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post on our panel this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Letters, we've got letters. We go to Denise, who says, it's not loyalty, it's corruptibility when it comes to Trump. Everyone is loyal to the president slash party who chooses them, but not everyone is corrupt, and that is what Trump values most. It's for his gain, right? It's for Trump's gain.
Totally, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. With Bessin, and if he does what he wants him to do with the economy, I'm sure Trump's trust funds will expand exponentially. It's all about money.
All right. Get ready, Libby.
Okay.
Randy writes, Libby really needs to get over herself. She finally has a voice at the table, and that's no good. Are you kidding me? That from Randy. I honestly don't quite know what that means.
Randy, if you think Besant is going to be speaking on behalf of the LGBTQ community at that table, I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you.
Mary writes, I'm no fan of RFK Jr., but I agree with his proposal to modify what people can buy with food stamps. The government is subsidizing the purchase of candy, soft drinks, sugar packs, cereal, fatty snacks, etc., by folks who develop health problems as a result and then drain health care resources. RFK isn't the guy to fix this, but it should be fixed. Well, that's one of many, many things that he'll be in charge of.
You know, I think it's also interesting when Michelle Obama tried to change the way that Americans were thinking about their food, she was absolutely pilloried.
That's right.
And so he comes along and does the same thing on this one issue. I'm not saying it's an unimportant issue, but it's, as you said, Joe, one of many, many things. And, you know, even what do they say? Even a blind squirrel finds a nut sometimes. Yeah, he might be right about that, but there's plenty of other things that are not only, I would say, incorrect, but dangerous.
But
I don't know about that. I mean, I'm a big fan of healthy food. I agree. Sugar cereals, you know, is not good for you. But I think it's not a good tool for if this happens to happen, for government to say you can only buy certain kinds of foods with food stamps. It should be voluntary. And it's not consistent with RFK's other points of view, like, you know, fluoride should not be mandatory. I do think that, you know, we have the right in this country to make really bad choices. And it is in some sense our right. And so for the government to be telling us, which doesn't seem to be the philosophy of this group anyway, you know, what we're supposed to be doing, eating, you know, et cetera, doesn't seem, except for our reproductive rights, by the way, doesn't seem to be, like, consistent.
I remember when there were restrictions on what people could buy with their food stamps. And it's a very entitled perspective to say what somebody else should be doing with their food stamps. It's none of your business, as Tim Walz said. And it's not, you know, it's the folks who get the food stamps, it's their responsibility to feed their families. Yes, sometimes people don't make good choices. But you know what? Those of us who don't get food stamps, we make pretty bad choices in the food we eat, too.
Let's just remember SNAP stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
Well, I get that, but it's very entitled to say what other people should be eating, and I find it to be sort of not okay. I mean, I could say other things, but I know I just got in trouble for saying what I just said.
I think I caught it in time.
Oh,
all right.
Did you? Okay.
Let's go to WP, who writes, in response to the discussion around the idea that his participation in the cabinet is a betrayal, perhaps he wants to be in the inside to be able to influence Trump and contain some of his counterparts. Wouldn't you rather have an insider at the table than another pure cookie-cutter follower?
You know, it would be nice if you were right. Well, only time will tell.
That's the old LBJ line. Would you rather have them
inside the tent doing something out of it, or outside doing it in?
Correct.
And I get it, and I agree with JFK. LBJ.
LBJ.
But
RFK. A lot of letters.
Yeah, I know. But this is Trump is in bed with people who would want to see us dead, and people don't quite get that. And now Besant is going to be complicit with them.
When the deficit balloons, writes Raina, inflation rises and prices go up, who will be blamed? Not Trump. He needs someone to blame, so who better than
great
Besant, a gay man who once worked for Soros? That from Raina. And all right. What's anybody on that? No? Okay.
Intriguing theory.
Yes, indeed. Can we discuss the fact that Trump hasn't signed transition contracts yet and his team is currently operating on secret money undisclosed to the public? We can, sure.
Yeah.
anybody
for the next 4 years. For the next 4 years, we are going to, discuss, hopefully only for the next 4 years, we're going to discuss how Trump doesn't do the usual way and just does what he wants. So let us just say now, he's not going to take the usual way, and he's just going to do what he wants. That's what he's done, our whole public experience with him.
All right.
Now, I just got something from, it wasn't a letter, but from my friend Leslie, who's listening down in New York, and she made the point of the availability of healthy food to food stamp recipients is limited, and that's really true. A lot of these folks live in food deserts where the corner bodega is the only thing available to them. So we need to understand that as well.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have many other topics to discuss. We'll get to those on the other side of the break. Panel at WAMC.org. First, news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 25th of November. Let me reintroduce everybody so you know who is participating. Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Security at Harvard University. Fran Berman is here. Laurel Elder, Professor of Political Science at Hartwick College in Oneonta, who studies gender and politics, women political candidates, women voters, and women in elected office. Jim Ketterer is a senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement and a Libby Post lobbyist and political consultant, and we welcome them all to the program. Let us go to other things on our docket this morning, and there are many things. So let's talk about North Carolina and voter ID. Mm-hmm. The New York Times reports about the surprising impact of North Carolina's new voter ID law. After a decade of battles over voter ID, the law that finally went into effect landed with a whimper, not a bang. After more than a decade of court battles and legislative jousting over voting rules, North Carolina this month held its first general election under its new voter ID law. And unlike the pitched battles of the past, it felt like a fight that had largely been fought to a draw with a more muted ID requirement and very few ballots that were actually disqualified. In 2013, when North Carolina's Republican-run state legislature first required voters to pull out a photo ID card before casting a ballot, it stirred a hornet's nest of protests that the real goal was to keep non-white, mostly Democratic voters from the polls. Years of litigation followed when a federal court struck down the law in 2016. The opinion highlighted the ID requirement as one of several provisions that targeted black voters with almost surgical precision. That in quotes. This month, voters cast 5.7 million ballots under a new Republican-written voter ID law. How things have changed. Now, North Carolina's law is being criticized by some on the right as too weak and porous, though the vote, by all accounts, went smoothly. The law, approved in 2018, but stalled by court battles until last year, requires both in-person and mail voters to show proof of identity that departs from most laws that require an ID only at the polls. Libby?
Well, I'm glad that this hasn't had the incredible negative impact. It's had some negative impact, but not what we had hoped. Not hoped, but what we had expected. The courts and advocates kept watering it down. But it was unfortunate that those voters who could have done an affidavit ballot didn't. So there was a thousand or so more votes that didn't get counted. Not that it was going to sway the outcome of the national election, but it could have had an impact on local. But the fact of the matter is that ID cards for voting is a way of keeping poor people and people of color from voting. And it shouldn't happen. I mean, every time we go to vote, Lynn's like picks up her pocketbook. I'm like, you don't need to show an ID. You know, we don't need to do that here in New York because they look at your signature. And if your signature matches, then that's it. And we're ready to rock and roll. And that's the way it should be. With all the technology that has come into being, there's ways of making sure that the person who's coming to vote is the person. And the other part of this is we know election fraud doesn't happen. We know this. Time and time and time again, they say it does. It's proven that it doesn't. Yet it doesn't matter because we all know now facts don't matter to, well, a large swath of our electorate and our citizenry. And we need to somehow get back to that facts do matter and that expertise does matter, like what you were saying before, Jim. You know, it's one of those things where it's going to be a long battle, but we really cannot give up on that battle.
Jim?
Yeah, so I agree with all of that, Libby. I would say just in general, you know, it seems to me because there is, whether it's ill-founded or not, there are so many questions about the legitimacy of our voting processes and confidence in the institutions, the administrative institutions that run our elections, which are, you know, especially in the U.S., it's such a decentralized system. It's really complicated. But given that, you know, I think what we have seen maybe just almost inadvertently in North Carolina is striking some balance between giving some sense of confidence in the system, and at the same time, not overly suppressing, and hopefully not at all suppressing the vote. And, you know, I worked the polls this year, and I found that many people did want to show their IDs. There's also a way in New York where you can scan, if you're licensed, you can use that instead of your, instead of just, you know, me looking up the name. But you still have to sign. You still have to go through the rest of the process. So I've worked on elections around the world as well. And I think almost all, if not all, of the other places that I've worked, you have to show a government ID. And that's because in almost every other country in the world, there are national government IDs that everyone has. And we simply don't have it. But anyway, I think striking that balance is something that appears to have happened in North Carolina, and it might be an interesting case for other states to look at.
Fran?
Yeah, you know, this whole thing made me wonder, you know, this is like a hate Elon, if we had a good Elon. why don't we have the same eligibility and voting requirements and rules in every state? I mean, they're all different. It's a consequence of federalism and the way, you know, things have evolved since the beginning of our country. But if you really wanted to make things efficient and open, you could have, in Fran's world, some ideal set of eligibility requirements, which lets, you know, a whole ton of people vote with reasonable documentation and not extreme documentation, and puts forward rules about, you know, mail-in and early voting and whether you can vote online and all kinds of stuff. Imagine just cleaning that up. So we don't have these arguments in every state, and so that states are comparable. You know, I've lived in California and Washington State and New York State and now Massachusetts. And, you know, the rules in all of these states are different. And every time I had to, like, figure out, okay, you know, what goes on? Wouldn't it be great if they were all the same? I mean, I know I'm, like, being out there in the, you know, ideal world ether here. But it does cause me to wonder why we're doing all this differently.
Yeah, but we don't want this administration, this incoming administration, to make those rules.
I have very little confidence that we would get good rules with this administration.
Right.
Laurel.
I agree with something Jim said, that it's important that people can trust the electoral process. We kind of have an amazing electoral process. The counties across the country, the Board of Elections do amazing work with our electoral system. And it would be a better situation if people had faith in it. So I do think thinking about reforms we could enact that would increase that. But at the same time, I would say the bigger issue is not voter fraud, people voting who aren't citizens, which, as people point out, it's very rare. It's that getting more people to participate, the essence of our democracy. I think in this last election, there was like 63.6% turnout, which is, you know, the second highest in like a century. It's like great for us. But that still means that there's like 37% of American citizens who didn't participate in this election. And I do think it would be worthwhile to invest more time in thinking about how we could make the voting process easier. Most other democracies have automatic voter registration. But in the United States, you have to, as an individual, take that extra step of registering to vote and then changing your voter registration every time you move, which, as someone who works with a lot of young people who are a very mobile population, I see that that is definitely a barrier to voting. But in the end, I also think there's a lot of political science research that shows that these voter ID laws, despite concerns, have not had any kind of meaningful impact on depressing voter turnout. And then the one other thing I was thinking is that historically it's been Republicans who have been pushing for these voter ID laws for political reasons, for racially motivated reasons in many ways. But now I think the thinking was that higher turnout would always advantage the Democrats. And now mm-hmm. I think we're starting to see that shift. And there was a lot of low propensity voters who went out to vote this year and voted for Trump. So I'm curious to see how that reality might shift this decade-long debate where we've been having about voter ID laws.
All right. Anyone else? All right. Two letters, and then we're going to move on to another topic. Akasha says, I am on food stamps. I also eat a healthy diet and exercise as I am able. When on my birthday, I went to get myself one of those small cakes that two people can eat and whipped out my SNAP card. I was called out. I hadn't had a birthday cake in years. I wanted to celebrate and share it with two other people. It's absolutely a privileged view to say what a person on food assistance can or cannot eat. What about a single parent who wants to make a cake for their child? There is always a very human story underneath the choice that gets forgotten. That's a great letter.
Mm-hmm. It is.
We also go to Steve. Isn't it in the government's interest to foster good health in the population, especially a population that's more likely to need Medicaid dollars? All right. Now, let's move on to other topics, and we check in on these particular my computer is acting funky this morning. sorry.
What do you want to talk about?
No, I'm good now. I think I'm okay, but it's annoying. All right. The U.S. is proposing a breakup of Google to fix the search monopoly. In a landmark antitrust case, the government asked a judge to force the company to sell its popular Chrome browser. I'm sure you are all familiar with Chrome, and if not, good on you. The request followed a landmark ruling in August by Judge Ahmed Mehta of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia that found Google had illegally maintained a monopoly in online search. Judge Mehta asked the Justice Department in the states that brought the antitrust case to submit solutions by the end of Wednesday to correct the search monopoly. Beyond the sale of Chrome, the government asked the judge to give Google a choice: either sell Android, its smartphone operating system, or be barred from making its services mandatory on phones that use Android to operate. If Google broke those terms or the remedies failed to improve competition, the government could force the company to sell Android at a later date. In a sweeping filing, the government also asked the judge to stop Google from entering into paid agreements with Apple and others to be the automatically selected search engine on smartphones and in browsers. The court should also require Google to allow rival search engines to display the company's results and have access to its data for a decade, according to the government. Fran Berman.
Some tech. Yeah, this is really interesting. And, you know, it sounds like a lot of tech legalese, which I'm sure many listeners are not excited about. But it's kind of an important thing that the Biden administration has done. And we will see its evolution over the next year. So here's what happened. Last summer, Judge Mehta, after, you know, some years at this suit, said that Google had abused monopoly over search business. So what that means is that the Google search engine is a monopoly for a number of different things that I'll talk about in a second. And Judge Mehta said that Google needs to be held accountable for this monopoly. And but how is Google going to be held accountable? So the Department of Justice, who brought the suit, has recommended a number of things, which I'll talk about in a second. And next month, Google will counter-recommend a set of things. And then after the inauguration, the Department of Justice will follow through on something somehow hard to say. So there's a lot of unknowns in this, but here's the, it's kind of a win for the Biden administration in the following way. It's pretty clear that Google is monopolistic, and think of it this way. So there's two things to know about. There's a browser and a search engine. So search engine finds the information, indexes the internet, does a whole bunch of things that allow you to find what you want. And you can think of Google or Bing or DuckDuckGo or whatever you use. And your browser is the software that lets you display websites and online content. So it basically translates the web addresses that you get from your search engine into things that you can see. And by the way, you know, things that, you know, might have cookies or in some sense have something to do with your privacy. The browser is kind of the gateway, and a search engine indexes the information and provides it. So maybe that's a little geeky, and I apologize. But what happens with Google now is it's like having a Subaru, and you go to your Subaru dealer, and your Subaru mechanic buys Subaru parts for your Subaru. So it's all together, and Subaru makes a lot of money. What Google has done is do the equivalent of pay mechanics at independent places, facilities, to use Subaru parts on your Subaru. So either way, Subaru is winning. And what the Department of Justice wants to do is not allow your mechanic to use Subaru parts preferentially on your Subaru. They could use a variety of parts. Maybe there's a generic part or something like that. So stop me if I'm being confusing. So the Department of Justice recommended a bunch of remediation, some of which would really dramatically change cyberspace for us. They recommended selling Chrome, so Chrome would be independent. Not clear, you know, how that would happen, and that would change Google. They recommended selling off Android, which is a mechanism to get there. One of the things they recommended, which seems to me to be way more likely, is that to prevent Google from favoring Google products as a default with Safari or with Bing or with, you know, DuckDuckGo. And, you know, that's like saying the mechanic from the independent facility can't preferentially think of Subaru parts as the default. And then there's a bunch of other things. You know, if they required Google to sell their search and sell their search index, that would give a lot of people a competitive advantage. If they required online publishers, that's you and I, when we write a blog, to opt out of having Google track our content with AI, that would make a difference. So there's lots of things that would make a difference. Not clear what's going to happen. But if something happens, and something will happen, it could be, you know, a small but important change, or it could be a dramatic change. So this is an important article, and it kind of sets us up. If it was a Harris administration, we would probably be seeing much bigger penalties. But the interesting thing is that, you know, Trump says China is afraid of Google, and he wants more, and I put this in air quotes, good stories about himself than bad stories on Google.
Yeah.
So, you know, they may actually do something. They may settle. Many think that that's a likely scenario. But, you know, this administration, Elon notwithstanding, is going to be heavy into tech. And not heavy into tech for the public good, but heavy into tech for competitive advantage, for, you know, blunt tools with social media and other things that they can, you know, try to manipulate both the U.S. and other places in the world with. So, you know, fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a wild ride.
All right. So kudos on explaining all that, because it's confusing, and you did a great job. Let me be the dumb guy here, because I have this question. And it's an example more than a specific, but it's an example of the kind of questions I have. So you talk about Android and the possibility that they would have to rid themselves of Android. So is that Android the mobile operating system, or is that Android the devices, the phones, the dot, dot, dot?
My sense is that it's the operating system.
Okay.
But if I'm wrong, readers, call in and, you know, tell me, Fran, you're imperfect, and I'll be shocked.
Because they're called Android phones. So then you would still get an Android phone, it wouldn't be the operating system, perhaps, that would be attached to it.
No, but the operating system can, you know, advantage you towards making one choice over another. And so it can certainly make it easier to use a Google search engine, and it could be advantage you with all kinds of efficiencies for Chrome. And so, you know, all of those things work together. Your search engine works with the software, which works with the hardware device. And when all of those are, you know, singing the same song, you get efficiencies of scale that you can't get when you do them independently.
I have a question.
Go.
If they are separated out and you can buy a Google phone, but you don't have to have the Google software, right, the Android software.
Well, A Google phone does have Android software.
Right, but if it's all, you know, if Google is made to sell the software, right, and so the Android might come with it, but then will the Android be the user be able to say, oh, I don't want to use Android, I want to use iOS? Is that something that could happen in all of this, that you can use the Apple software on a Android phone?
That's a really good question. An Android phone is called an Android phone because it uses the Android operating system.
Right, which is Google.
So imagine some third party, you know, makes the phone and it markets it as an Android phone. It needs the Android operating system.
So, in other words, so it would seem to me then under this story that we're making up here.
Proposed mitigation.
Yes, would be that then Google would make the phone, but Android, if they have to get rid of Android, then they could be in an agreement with Android to use the operating system within the phone. It just wouldn't then be a Google product.
So, first of all of these are proposed things by the Department of Justice. So none of these things have been, you know, approved or as a final judgment by Judge Mehta. And Google is going to give its own set of things. There are a number of phones that use the Android operating system. So, you know, whether they can now use iOS, it just seems to me if it's an Android phone, it uses an Android operating system.
Anybody else?
Yeah,
one minute.
So yeah. I'm just wondering, is this likely if most or all of the mitigation components that DOJ has requested, if they're put in place, Fran, is this likely to be good for consumers or not? And, you know, I think back to other large entities that were broken up. Was the breakup of the Bell system good for right. consumers, or did it create chaos? Or what's your sense, Fran, how this is likely to shake out from the perspective of the consumer?
Now, Fran, we have exactly 20 seconds. So would you like to pause and then we'll you can answer that on the other side of the break?
I think you just used up 15 of the 20 seconds. I'll talk on the other end of the break.
I was certainly pushing you in one direction there, no question about it. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with our wonderful group for this Monday morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. Okay, Fran, ball's in your court. You were about to answer a question. Go ahead.
And I'm dribbling as we speak. Let me just finish off this other set of questions about Android phones, which are phones that have the Android operating system. They're made by Google, but they're also made by Samsung and other people. If the Android operating system has to be decoupled, you know, my guess there's going to be some partnership agreement of some sort. So, you know, everything would be in the, you know, mushy area. Back to this great question about, is this good for consumers? What could happen? And in some sense, you would think decoupling things is good for consumers, and there's some reasons why. If Google's search engine is not preferential, not put in as the default for, you know, everything you buy that has a search engine in it, it means that it gives other search engines more of a competitive advantage. So, you know, if your mechanic always puts in Subaru parts, there's no competitive advantage for the other parts. If the other parts can be put in, you at least have a choice. So having it decoupled, having the preference be decoupled is actually, you know, good for competitiveness. The other thing that's super important to think about is every time you use Google search engine, your queries and your responses have a lot to do with how Google is training its AI. So all of that becomes data for Google's own version of its AI. And the more you use Google search engine, the more competitive its the more competitive its search engine is going to be, but also the more competitive its AI is going to be. And so that's really important, because if we set things up so it's always Google, then Google will always win because it's better and everybody wants to use the good thing. If we set things up so there's more competition, which is exactly what antitrust is all about, we set things up so other people have a chance to play and other people have a chance to innovate. Does that help?
It does. It very much helps. So, and we don't know how this is all going to go. I guess the one thing that... So let me ask you the final thing here, which and then we'll move on to other stuff. But it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong on this, and I guess maybe this is always the case, and I'm just being naive. But the judge has a lot of latitude / power here.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you know, if they settle, you know, that's a negotiation, and. So, you know, there's a lot of things that can happen between now and whatever the final thing is. And by the way, after the final judgment, you're going to have to enforce it. So the degree of excitement they have about enforcing this and the mechanisms for enforcing it also make a difference. So, you know, it's a broad playing field here.
Anybody
but,
else?
You know, just a small kudo to the Biden administration, who has been pursuing what I like to think of as public interest focused technology legislation, you know, throughout. We've seen net neutrality with him that might go away. We've seen these antitrust laws. We've seen things about social media. All of that's going to look different in the next administration is my prediction.
I would just say I agree with Fran that these big tech companies, they play a huge role in our everyday lives, and that also there's real risks in these companies dominating the way they do. And despite their image being all about innovation, that, you know, the power that Google has really much stifles innovation. It's hard to break into that space now. I guess I just have a little bit of concerns about the timing. Well, one thing is in this article, I talked about how Google's Chrome didn't emerge until 2008. And I was thinking, really? And that, like, what did we do before 2008? We didn't Google things. That wasn't. And so, I mean, it's just amazing how quickly it's become a huge part of our lives.
Well, we still use the Google search engine. We just used it via other kinds of browsers.
Other kinds of browsers. All right. And then, but I almost wonder, I think in this article it said the judge would come to some kind of decision at the end of the summer. But like our technology and our use of these search engines is changing so quickly. AI is getting incorporated into it already when you do a Google search. Mm-hmm. It's it gives you the AI results. I remember going to a talk last fall. I hadn't ever used ChatGPT or anything like that. It was about the use of AI in local government. And the guy leading the workshop was basically like, once you do a ChatGPT or AI search, you're never going back to Google. And he's like, it's just so far superior. And, you know, so already we're seeing, you know, this being embedded. And I just wonder, like, where are we even going to be at the end of the summer? And like, by the time we make these recommendations about, you know, selling off Chrome, like it might be irrelevant. Like AI may have changed the landscape by then.
Well, the AI by the end of next summer is going to be, you know, even better than today's AI for sure. And whether it's now or later, selling off Chrome would be a huge deal because Chrome is extremely popular. And by the way, you're less private on Chrome than you are on other like non-private browsers. But let me just like at, you know, throw in a recommendation. So, you know, think of ChatGPT as kind of a, I don't know, like a not so good librarian or your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving. ChatGPT will tell you things, and some of them will be right, you know, not all of them will be completely innovative and creative, but some of them will be right, but some of them will be wrong. And it will talk with the same authority for right and wrong. So ChatGPT is enormously useful, and, you know, that's like a whole other show to talk about all the different ways it can be used. But it should always be your co-pilot. Mm-hmm. And the human should always be the pilot, and you should always vet everything ChatGPT tells you. And with the new browsers, you're starting to see citations to real stuff, which is good because, you know, when ChatGPT says something, I want to check it out. And you should always check out anything of importance that ChatGPT tells you. So that's my Thanksgiving gift to, you know, everyone, is just to remind you, you know, you don't have to, like, throw out ChatGPT, but always vet the information it gives you with humans and real citations and legitimate evidence.
Okay, so AI and a doctor walk into
an operating room.
Walk into an operating room and or in an exam room, and we were just talking about ChatGPT and AI, of course. So there is this study that has come out, and this will make you feel great, folks. A small study found that ChatGPT outdid human physicians when assessing medical case histories, even when those doctors were using a chatbot. So
how does that work?
So OpenAI scored an average of 90% when diagnosing a medical condition from a case report and explaining its reasoning. Doctors randomly assigned to use the chatbot got an average score of 76%. Those randomly assigned not to use it had an average score of 74%. The study showed more than just the chatbot's superior performance and unveiled doctors' sometimes unwavering belief in a diagnosis they made, even when a chatbot potentially suggests a better one. And the study illustrated that while doctors are being exposed to the tools of artificial intelligence for their work, few know how to exploit the abilities of chatbots. As a result, they failed to take advantage of AI systems' ability to solve complex diagnostic problems and other explanations for their diagnosis. So, Fran, I look at this and I say, so that last part is the most important part, which is it's not so much the results of what we see from this, but it's that doctors aren't using it correctly.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you'll see a bunch of articles like this, and they're, in a sense, a little bit silly because it's like an apples and oranges comparison. If you looked at the chatbot alone, it's doing analysis of cases. And so it's learning from and basically pattern matching. It's not actual thinking. But it's learning from the many, many cases out there and drawing inferences, just like computers have done for a long time. If you compare that for the doctors with AI, it looks like, from at least from the article, that many of the doctors weren't using the AI for analysis. They were using the AI just like a search engine for queries. You know, what is this? Or, you know, how is that? And so that's not really an apples to apples comparison. And here's the way that I think about this. Do you guys ever watch the TV show House?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, like some crazy, innovative, creative doctor that can always see, you know, the using his experience to see, oh, my God, you know, their carbon monoxide alarm went off, or my gut feeling is that it looks like this. And those are things that ChatGPT can't do. It only has the comparison parameters that have been trained into it. And it doesn't have this whole wealth of sort of gut feeling and experience that actual doctors have. So it's clear, at least from this study, that the win is having computers do what computers do best, which is like triage among a huge amount of materials and provide some likely results. And then using that triage to complement their own knowledge, their own experience, their own gut feeling, their own, you know, knowledge, and to use it as a tool, as a co-pilot, to do something interesting. But this study didn't look at that. This study, you know, primarily looked at use it as a search engine or let it do analysis by itself. At least that's what it looked like for me. AI is great when you use it as a co-pilot, but you got to check it because it's sometimes flaky and it's like sometimes does not have the experience you have. And it's not thinking. It's pattern matching at a super sophisticated level. And so, you know, you're the one who can do thinking and be creative. So that's what you should be doing.
It's very
and
nice
by the way,
yes.
Computers have no feelings either. They don't know what it's like to be sad. They don't know what it's like to be hopeful. And all of those things are factored into our decisions as well. So we love computers. Computers are great, but we shouldn't assume that computers are people and that they can do everything.
All right. Anybody want the last word? Okay, then I'll take it. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning and for being a part of the program. Thanks to Jim Ketter. He had to leave early, but we thank him very much for being with us. Fran Berman, it's been a long time. It's wonderful to hear your voice. I thank you so much for being on this morning.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
And to you. Thank you very much. Laurel, great to have you back. Thank you very much. Best of luck in all of your work as you wind up the semester. Thank you.
Thank you.
Look forward to having you back. And Libby, we'll see you soon.
Yeah, happy Turkey Day, everybody.
And to you. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Libby. We'll be back right after this.